Hello, welcome to the Entrepreneurial Spirit in the Enterprise podcast. This is your host, Aaron Eden. I'm the co-founder and chief operating officer here at Moves the Needle. And this week we've got a special treat. This is actually pulled from a live show that we did a few weeks ago. And we're going to discuss the three customer experience imperatives for winning in the 21st century. Forced with immense and accelerating challenges, winning organizations are developing three customer-centric disciplines. Those are design for delight, delivering for delight, and engaging customers, talent, and partners for delight. We have the pleasure of the presence of Mike Kendall, and he's one of my ex-Intuit Innovation Catalyst friends. And we're going to cover some practical steps that your organization can take to win new customers, to retain existing customers, and to build a culture of rapid learning and innovation. So without further ado, welcome to the show, Mike.
Hi, Aaron. Doing well. How are you?
Awesome. Awesome. I'm secretly in a hotel room in Madison, so try to make it look homey, but hopefully the internet here in the hotel behaves well. For those of you that are joining us now, welcome to our special episode of Entrepreneurial Spirit in the Enterprise. We're doing a live show today, so exciting opportunity of Customer Experience Week. Customer Experience Day was on Tuesday. So, building on that, we've got a special episode here with Mike Kendall, and we're going to be focused on delivering delightful customer experience at scale. And so super excited. And I'm one of the co-founders and chief operating officer for Moves the Needle. And let's see here. Actually, you know, I wanted to share just a couple of upcoming we've got going on for Moves the Needle. I don't know what the deal is. I think October, November is like conference season, something like that. So we've got the Innovation Leader Teach-In at MIT in Boston. I'll be out there along with a handful of our other folks. The biggest one is Lean Startup Week. So Lean Startup Week is the Halloween through third or fourth, something like that, that week. Probably about 20 of us Moves the Needle folks out there for the conference. We're sponsoring again this year. We're doing a public innovation sprint. We're doing a couple of dinners, an executive version and a practitioner version. It's going to be absolutely insane. Brant and Simeon are doing a session called the CFO's Rosetta Stone. So how to really effectively communicate with your CFO and get them on board, transforming your organization. So lots of good stuff going on there. You can check out movesneedle.com, or we've got a landing page for Lean Startup Week, which is lsw17.movesneedle.com. And as always, you can catch us on Twitter or any of the other places. So without further ado, our special guest, Mike Kendall. So why don't we start by, Mike, if you just give us a little background about yourself, let everybody know who you are and where you come from.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron. Appreciate it. Sounds like some exciting things going on in the next couple months. So Aaron and I know each other from some Intuit days a few years ago, but wanted to give you a little bit of insights on my background. At Intuit, we used to use a term called purple squirrel, which I guess meant that you were just weird or had a strange background. But mine is a little bit eclectic. My passion is really to help leaders and help organizations transform their business, especially around becoming more customer-centric. And have had the privilege of doing that at several companies that have done really well with it. Intuit was a leader there for customer experience and in the operations area. Also a CX leader at Capital One, and was one of the co-founders at Humana of the CX Innovation Lab that they put together there. in the Wayback Machine. I was a Six Sigma Master Black Belt at Citi and did a lot of process improvement and re-engineering work there. And also our time at Intuit, Aaron and I both were innovation catalysts helping scale out lean innovation across the enterprise. And on a personal note, I'm a cyclist, a drummer, and a food guy. So my wife and I like to travel around and eat a lot. So some people say that's a foodie. I'm not sure. But the drumming thing we decided not to do today. But that's something that I've been doing since I was a kid and doesn't pay the bills, but it's taken me around the world. So it's been a lot of fun.
We need some good theme music for the podcast. So maybe you can maybe you can crank something out there. So for the introduction, I'm excited to get to reconnect here. I love what others are creating in their organizations, and I know you did some really incredible work at Humana and at Capital One as well. So I know that there's lots of goodness for you to share with everybody that's listening right now. So why don't we dive into that? Maybe a little bit around kind of the history of customer experience. What is customer experience? Why is it even important? Why do we have a CX day or a CX week? Why is this worth celebrating?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was at a conference a few days ago in Atlanta. And it was kind of unique because they pulled together about 18 different trade associations that either were UX or CX or marketing or something like that. And everybody said they were doing customer experience. So it seems to be a big topic right now that you get 15 different answers when you ask what it is. But I think if it gives you some perspective, if you go back a few years, you think about maybe our parents or our grandparents' generation. And for them, the experience was really a product experience. It was something where you maybe had three car companies and most of the cars were the same, or you had one telephone, a black phone with a little dial on it, and one phone company. There weren't plans and screens and data packages and all kinds of things. So it was pretty simple back then. It was price versus quality, and you took what you could get. If you move forward a little bit into the 70s, you started seeing branding and advertising become a bigger thing, and people trying to differentiate around the brand image. And probably the most iconic example of that were the cola wars between Pepsi and Coke. And any of you old enough to remember, they had this thing called the Pepsi Challenge, where they'd blindfold people and put a Coke and a Pepsi in front of them and have them take a drink. And overwhelmingly, Pepsi won it. But who won the market share? It was really Coke. And that was a lot around the image they created, the branding. And so that was kind of that era. You kind of shifted a little bit forward, especially when you start to see the personal computer. You think about what was going on at Palo Alto Research, Xerox's lab in Silicon Valley. At the time, developing graphic user interfaces, the mouse, and Steve Jobs pops in, and pretty soon we see a lot of this stuff show up on the Macintosh. And it's a new era of less about marketing and more about interacting with users, making things easier, and looking at features that can actually solve real problems. And that's still a lot of that's going on now, but as companies have gotten bigger, things have gotten more complicated, massive call centers, online support, you started to see in the last few years this CX or customer experience discipline arise, which is really, how do I take all those interaction points, not just the product, but the sales experience and the shopping experience all the way through the use experience and through the closeout or payoff or whatever happens at the end, and how do I make that seamless so that it feels like one experience and it's not a bunch of different silos? And I would say the jury's still out at a lot of companies on this. It's hard work, and that's why I think it's such a big topic right now. There's a lot of new tools and techniques and consultants and all kinds of things going on in that space. But I think there's some companies that have got it, and I think we're maybe almost coming into a newer era, but this one I think is sort of where we're rooted now and starting to figure out how do we do this well and how do we look to the future.
Awesome. Maybe you could give a quick example of what that looks like from your past experiences for folks that are not as deep in the CX world as we are, maybe a quick example of something that you might do as a CX leader.
Yeah. So, maybe take you back to the Intuit days where you think about, working with product development folks and digital designers, marketing, operations, data centers, call centers. And a lot of times those folks all had different goals, different strategies. And one of the things we started doing there, and you see this at some companies like Toyota and other places where they'll put in place somebody that is sort of the air traffic controller or the architect across all those disciplines to bring some seamlessness to it. And the way you do it, there's a lot of different ways, but you start to have, versus just a bunch of silos, you have to start thinking, how do I cut through that and make the organization seem horizontal to a customer?
Got it. That makes sense. Good. Well, you hinted at in your description and sort of the context around that, that we're transitioning from CX into some, what does the future hold for us?
Yeah, I think it's relatively new, but if you take a look at some of the companies that really seem to be shining right now, there's maybe a newer era that we're starting to dip into, which I would call the human experience. And if you, for example, if you were to talk to anybody, maybe 35 years or so or younger, and ask them questions from those old eras and say, hey, why did you choose that product? Or why did you choose the coffee shop or the shirt you're wearing and the different things you do? The chances are you won't hear so much about price versus quality or user experience or even how seamless the end-to-end experience with that company is. It's probably going to be more about they share my values. The company shares my values. They have a noble purpose that I identify with. And so the product's still there and those other things are important, but it's not necessarily the deciding factor. And I think that's a huge shift for a lot of us that are used to the old eras, because now it could be 3 a.m. on a call center, a support call, or it could be a far-flung retail location where there's nobody to approve some change or solve a problem. The customer's really looking at how authentic is that experience going to be? Are they living the values? And it can't just be marketing and brand. It's got to be real. And that's a different, it gets into culture more so than just design or experience.
Oh, my mute button didn't go fast enough. So then, yeah, that's interesting. I was thinking about, I can't think of the name of the organization, but I was out in Europe a few months ago, and there was a bank that was focused on, it was just people of a specific lifestyle, and like it was perceived as super niche, but they were taking market share like crazy. And I think that I wish I could just remember the name of the organization, but it sounds like it's directly aligned with what you're talking about, which is just attaching to the values of your sharing the values of your customer base rather than sort of a marketing brand in between the two.
Yeah, and I think that I love that example because it's banking, right? And so having worked at a couple big banks, they're not necessarily always thinking as much about the emotion as they are the actual offering. And I think, you know, if you think of who are the stars at this right now, maybe Tom's Shoes or Warby Parker, where they actually have a defined, the purpose they exist to help those that are more needy with shoes or with eyeglasses. Even REI, the retail stores, a few years ago closed on Black Friday, which is usually the most profitable day for most retail stores. And they said to their members, hey, get out there, go out and hike or fish or get in a kayak, which is really their promise, you know, and their affiliation. And it frustrated maybe some of those millennials' parents who wanted to go shopping for them. But when they came back online, essentially, their sales spiked because people said, hey, you weren't in it for a quick buck. You were really living out the values that we believe in and why we shop there.
A really lightweight example, but the the fact that Chick-fil-A closes on Sundays. I swear, the day that I tend to go to Chick-fil-A is Sundays. I drive by, I'm like, oh, they're closed. but it's along those lines. Like that's in their values, and regardless of that, you know, that's what's right for them.
Yeah, and I don't know that that example is
to be open 24/7.
If you look at like the sales per square foot of fast food restaurants, they tend to outsell their competitors by quite a big margin, even being closed on Sunday.
So interesting. Awesome. So, so we're entering this new world. Let's get some specifics. In a large organization, and the world is changing around me, and customers are expecting experiences that are aligned with their individual values. That's a pretty tall order to ensure that my organization can survive this new world.
Yeah, I think it's real. It's a great question because it's easy to get kind of lost in the alphabet soup of customer and human experience and UX and all the different things that are out there and the tools and techniques and methods and books. And to me, I think exactly. I think, you know, the experience I've had at some fairly large and a couple small companies and sort of observation around the world here is that there's sort of three things I'm seeing emerge in companies that are really winning the day right now. And most companies don't get all three of these too well. They might get one or two, but all three together is unique, which I think is a huge opportunity for the companies that can nail all three. And the first would be around design, a customer-centric design. And I would use a big D versus a little. This is not just design thinking and all the specifics that go with that, but it's a mindset around thinking from a customer outside and working your way back into whatever your offering is end to end. The second would be around execution. So some companies design amazing offerings or products or services, but they fall down on actually delivering on those. So that operational excellence piece of it. And then the third element, which we've talked a little bit about already, is the culture part of it, which is customer-centered culture, which you can't fake that. That's the thing that, you know, at the really tough moment, that frontline person is empowered, has the ability, or just does the right thing for the customer, even though there's no policy, there's no rule, or in most companies, they might get fired because it was just the right thing to do. There's a culture that and an infrastructure and support and some maybe some structures around that, so that people are doing the right thing and it becomes sort of that upward flywheel effect.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, why don't we, will you give a little bit more specifics around the design side?
Yeah, so
I love stories and examples and anywhere you can throw in nuggets of changes that you've been able to live, I think are really beneficial for everybody that's watching.
Yeah, I'll give you one from healthcare, from my time at Humana. I think, you know, the most traditional organizations, it's a challenge sometimes, especially as you get big and complicated, to really hear and feel the emotion from customers. And you talk to IDEO or a lot of different places, and they always say start with emotion. But how do you do that at scale? And we work with Moves the Needle while I was there, and put together several workshops and approaches where we could get the CEO and the senior leaders, the C-suite folks, sitting next to side by side frontline reps taking phone calls. And so there's nothing more powerful than a CEO or a CIO sitting there, listening to the call and hearing somebody who's with cancer or somebody whose child is really sick and the mother's concerned about can she afford to take them to the doctor or not. It's one thing to see that comment in a survey or maybe hear it in a boardroom conversation, but to hear the passion, the emotion from the customer, and then to see the rep kind of freaking out because there's multiple screens and how do I do this and do I give them the right answer or not? It's a real moment of truth, I think. And we had just some amazing fruits from that. And so I think not just getting your designers out with customers and getting empathy, but getting your leaders out. And not only just on the phone, but we took them out to doctor's offices to nursing homes to shopping malls, grocery stores, wherever you would find customers, Medicare patients, you know, providers, and really start to see what the pain is and then pitch maybe some concepts and co-create some solutions with them.
One of my friends from Intuit was actually sharing with me a story about an initiative that either they're in the midst of running now or they recently kicked off, where literally the CEO challenged every employee to get out and do 4 or 5 follow me homes with customers over the course of the next 6 months. And they did this like attached to the state of the company tour. So it was kind of like the CEO would show up at that local site, would give state of the company and would kick this challenge off. And people were out with customers, you know, immediately around those to the state of the company events and those kinds of things. And so it continued on outside of those, you know, event-based opportunities. But I think it's a wonderful example of this is not just for your design team. This is not just for your CX people, but the leaders from the very top down need to be living these principles and embodying that for everybody to see.
Yeah, I think that's great. And one of the other big challenges I've seen at companies is kind of breaking down the silos. So in banking or in healthcare, you have a lot of regulations. You have to be very careful and manage the risk. And one of the things we did at Humana is we actually brought attorneys into our cross-functional design teams. We brought HR folks in, people from marketing, maybe areas that wouldn't hear about the designs or would have said, you can't do that. Really down the road, they were right in the kitchen. And the DNA that created was almost like a game going back with the other attorneys to say, here's the spirit of what we want to do. Is it legal? Is it not? Does it fit our values? And we kind of came up with some guidelines of making sure that it was legal, but had the blessing of the legal department right at the front end. And they were talking to customers as well.
I remember some of those. It wasn't all cupcakes and rainbows. There were definitely some some folks that were more supportive than others. But eventually we got there.
Yeah.
Awesome. So let's dive into delivery. Where do you appreciate the delivery from the design side of it, and is that really the pieces where you start to get into how this operates at scale versus being able to do this in a startup, or what do you see for that?
Yeah, well, I think there's maybe three elements, and I'll maybe go into one that we don't talk a lot about, but there's obviously the Six Sigma, Lean, Kaizen kind of enterprise process management stuff that I find a lot of the really creative, innovative, entrepreneurial companies aren't so good at that part of it. So, you know, if you've got people that run data centers and they need to be up all the time because you have a SaaS offering, for example, how likely is that person going to get promoted versus somebody who creates the next killer app? You know, those kind of questions, you know, start to say, hey, how does this work end to end? Do we put that much effort or insight into what we're doing on the execution side? The other piece to it, I think, is the element of ownership. And this is where, as the company gets bigger, they start to have some challenges. And I mentioned earlier this idea of what I'd call strong product owner or an end-to-end experience owner, an XO, somebody who has the authority, the accountability, and gets the recognition or rewards for the end-to-end experience, for whether it's net promoter or revenue or however you measure the success of that end-to-end experience. And then they have to kind of have a network of these experience champions or XCs that they can then bring together. And for example, at Intuit, we created for each of our major products an XO and XCs in our division. We pulled them together weekly, and then we have monthly and quarterly strategy meetings. But the XO, that experience owner, was really on point to be the one that worked with the first 1-year plan, the 3-year plan, the strategy, the budgets, and then negotiated all of that across with everybody. And so that was a big game changer, I think. And it's less common in a lot of companies where you have a lot of battles, and in some places call it governance, but just thinking through who's going to actually own this thing and not say, well, they own that part and they own that part. Customer doesn't care. They really just want to see a seamless experience.
Yeah, I don't care that that's handled by that other team. Should be consistent. So, yeah. You know, I'm realizing too, I should have mentioned that for those of you that are watching on the live stream right now, you can submit questions right on the YouTube page. On the right-hand side, there's a live chat. We'd love to take your questions for ones that fit nicely during the conversation. I'll bring them in during the live portion. We'll also have a chunk of time at the end of the conversation to hit questions as well. So please, any areas where you'd like to take this conversation, please do. The benefit of getting these things live. So part of it is you get to hear lots of ums and ahs from me, but it's all good. Mike, so we've talked, I lost my train of thought. All right. So we've talked about the design. We've talked about the delivery. Let's talk culture. I think from my perspective, it feels like you could really hit the design and the delivery components just fine. But if you don't get at the culture portions, it's still not gonna stick, and your organization still isn't gonna get the full benefit from all these things. So what do you see on the culture side?
Yeah, I think I would start with, and there's sort of the usual suspects, but I would start with sort of defining your organizational purpose and your values, really. I remember Scott Cook at Intuit. Every quarter we had Delight Forums, where he would bring in an interview in front of everybody on a live broadcast, thought leaders, CEOs, people from a lot of different great companies. And I don't remember if it was, I think, let's just say it was a well-known Silicon Valley company CEO. Don't want to quote it wrong, but he and Scott were buddies, and his company had grown tremendously. It's one that we all use today. And he asked Scott, he told Scott, he said, you know, you told me when I started this company that I really need to start by defining my company's purpose and my values and make them non-negotiable, so that we select the right people, that we have the right behaviors and guidelines. He said, I thought you were crazy. I thought we just needed to grow this thing, get venture capital, get users, you know, get paid premium subscriptions. And he said, now I think they're 6-7 years into it and really had grown quite a bit. He said, I wish I had listened to you, because now I'm unwinding all the bad behaviors. I've got senior leaders that we would have never hired if I'd known that they didn't share my personal values. And that was, I think, one of the beauties of the culture at Intuit, is that there was no ambiguity around what we believed. You know, integrity without compromise. We didn't even get close to the borders on things that were not fitting that description. Delight customers. I mean, those are right up at the top of the values. And at Humana, it was know me, show me you care, make it easy, help me. Those things were everywhere, and people were, if they weren't living it, they were getting called out on it. And so there was a self-correcting mechanism. So I think that's number one. The second one would be around how do you scale that? And that's really where you start to think about GE's FastWorks program, or the what you see with Innovation Catalysts into it, or how do you propagate the culture across, you know, everywhere, and coming up with something that says it's everybody's job to design for customers, to deliver for customers, and to do the right thing for customers. And there's definitely some programmatic things that can be done there as well. And then I think there's some operational day-to-day things. We use the term called scrappy but not crappy at Humana, which meant that you know, we'll still use a scientific approach to validate and learn, but we're not going to study something for 6 months when we can actually be out of the building testing it. The customer's voice versus the boss's voice. Was it okay for the frontline person to push back on the CEO? And we actually had interactions between those groups scheduled and put together to say, I get where you're going with this, but let me tell you what's really happening here. My customers don't like this, and here's why. So I think that the defining that architecture, and it's a little bit different for every company because they all have different histories, but really thinking through Where are you and where do you want to be in the future? And how do you architect that? I think Scott Cook, and this was before my time at Intuit, you might have been there, Aaron, after it had grown quite a bit, they went back to that and said, hey, we need to get everybody in the company involved in writing down these values. We'd all kind of understood them, but we need to put them in writing and then make sure everybody had a say in how that gets done.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's critical, and not just having them up on the wall, but ensuring that employees are living them every day. I think what I see in many of the organizations that we work with is situations where leaders aren't consistent about those things, and employees pick up on it immediately, and you can't put it up on the wall if your leadership isn't living it. Just won't work. And then the second thing that I see is if you think about the work of execution in the organization compared to the work of search, learning and developing new things and those kinds of things, the way that those values manifest themselves look different in those two different contexts. Helping employees and leaders to interpret that and translate that into, well, this value of transparency in my organization, if we value that, what does that look like when I'm executing on something that's known versus what does that look like in a situation where I'm learning something completely brand new? So that translation really, I think, trips a lot of people up. Be okay for it to look different in different contexts.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that's really critical in both the delivery and the culture part of it. Because and McKinsey a few years back came out with something called Horizon Planning, which you may have heard of and worked with some companies that have done this, but they very clearly delineate what is your current money-making product set versus maybe the newer products that are just newly profitable versus the things that are in that search phase where I'm just trying to test this out. I really don't know. The challenge a lot of companies have is they use the same sort of go, no go, or reinforcement mechanisms from senior leaders for all three, which the questions you ask for, am I going to make an investment in a current existing product, which is huge and at scale, and the ROI makes a lot of sense there. If it's something we haven't really even validated with customers yet to know if there's a there, asking for a spreadsheet and an ROI doesn't make a lot of sense. There's a whole different language you have to use. And that's hard to teach leaders that are very rooted in the day-to-day of running and optimizing an existing product set versus thinking more like a startup. And you need that because you need the pipeline. Those cash cows are not going to be there, the H1s forever. Those H3s have to come up. And so that's cultural as well as execution.
I have a question from one of our viewers that I think fits in with what we're talking about right now. So Mark from GoDaddy is asking, I'm sure that the idea of getting to the wild with customers wasn't easy. How do you drive this belief system in with the senior leadership team?
Yeah, I'll give you an example from Humana, I think, because it was pretty dramatic and pretty fast, where we had a new CEO had come in. We had a mixed team of leaders that had been around a while and then some new ones. And our team put together a four-day offsite, and we didn't involve the C-suite. It was just really kind of VP level and down all the way to frontline, about 60 people offsite. It's a huge company, right? 50,000 people. But we spent some time in Cincinnati, and we went out and talked to customers. We did some teaching and basically a boot camp, if you will, for this kind of thinking. And within a couple days, we had identified just a ton of great topics, some teams that we wanted to build and keep going. That got a lot of buzz, and we were invited to do a similar thing for the C-suite. So we architected a couple hour meeting, all we could do with them, and actually got them out listening to phone calls, guided by frontline reps, and taught them empathy mapping and some of the design tools. And that really broke through, I think, more so than maybe just a training workshop, because they're actually doing it and seeing the power. And we already had boots on the ground, if you will, that had come up with real tangible solutions. And we were essentially like Shark Tank pitching to say, hey, we want some money and we want some people to keep these teams going. Think if what we did in 4 days was so powerful, what we could do in 6 months if these teams stay together. And so I think the two combined together, experiential learning for the C-suite, as well as some real tangible business problems being solved using the same techniques, started to break that through. And then once we built the innovation lab, we had open houses every Thursday and invited all the senior leaders to come through, sit with the teams, talk to them, join our stand-ups, and then sort of see what was going on in real time. They were the sharks, if you will. They had sponsored these things, so they were just kind of checking in on their investments to see how they were going.
One, a couple of small things that I want to add to that. Now, hundreds and hundreds of boot camps with, you know, practitioners and leaders across many different organizations. And it's interesting, behavior that happens consistently is that the individuals that are part of these boot camps go out, interact with real customers, and energy level is through the roof. They're so excited. Yeah. They love it. And so, like in that example, I think even if you're able to just get a little bit of the senior leadership team to go through it, their excitement will spread throughout the rest of the leadership team. And it's very infectious. So, you know, starting small and then being able to grow it based on that momentum and excitement is really important. Now I'm spacing what the second thing that was that I wanted to add to that. There was a second thing. The second thing I wanted to add to that is, as an executive in the organization, at least two customers that I focus on. So number one is the customers that are outside of my company that I'm serving, that my organization is serving, but then the employees are also my customer. And so to empathize with their employees is often just as valuable as getting them out with customers outside the walls of the organization. And so it drives the same excitement, it drives the same attachment. And so, you know, experimenting with which of those resonates best with the leaders in your organization can help break down barriers around driving that belief system at the executive level.
Yeah, I think that's right. And when I was in the ops world at Intuit, you know, it at times seems like, you know, it's a never ending 24/7 kind of call center support advice type of thing. People and their taxes, anything to do with money is always super critical. And so it got really, really busy. And we were very focused on our leaders being on the floor serving food. You know, sometimes they couldn't get off a 2-hour phone call with a CPA to unwind a software issue. You know, bringing that person food or sitting down, taking the call, just a very kind of organic environment where you're also seeing and hearing while you're out there, very much of a kind of a Japanese management technique of going out to the place of the work, watching what's happening, seeing what's going on, whether it's your frontline associates or it's your customers. I think it was Coke a few years ago, the CEO for their Latin American operations had a really cool ad on, and he said something like, nothing good ever happens in a boardroom or on a whiteboard. And he was always out talking to customers and spending time with customers. So and I think it was Medtronic. I was visiting them in LA a few years back, and in their boardroom, they had pictures of their customers. A lot of them were young customers that had diabetes and were using their insulin pumps. So you'd see pictures of them in the boardroom, and then they had a chair at the head of the table that said customer, and nobody could sit in that chair. So they always wanted to consider, if the customer was there at the board meeting, what would they think about the decisions that were being made?
I love that. Those little tricks that can just remind you over and over again that actually the customer is in charge. I love it.
Yeah.
So with that question, I took us off on a little bit of a rabbit trail there. We were talking about really out of the framework that you described between design, delivery, and culture. We were digging into culture. Are there any other components of culture that you want to zoom in on?
Yeah, I think there's an element of how you structure your teams. Our CEO at Intuit called them two pizza teams, and something we adopted at Humana, which is if the team's bigger than can be fed by two pizzas, it's too big. And so these could be your cross-functional support teams. These could be your product development or your service development teams, your continuous improvement teams. But and there's a great example of a guy I used to work with that actually founded a business line starting on his own. It was sort of side of desk work, and he had the tools that had been taught to him to pitch these ideas to his management and said, hey, I think there's something here. We've tested it a little bit with some customers. Could I get an engineer part-time to help me? They're like, okay, sounds pretty good. Go, you've got 6 months and one engineer. And then that became two and three, and pretty soon he quit his regular job to become product manager of this new thing. Because there was a structure around how do I get my ideas heard by senior leaders, and then how do I keep my team really small and scrappy to the point where it's still one of those H3 new products. Once it starts to get big and make money, then yeah, you're going to go execute on this thing and build some bigger teams out. But while you're in that search mode, keeping those teams really small is important. And I think, and you did some great things, I think, at Intuit around teaching that. We did like 100 startups in 100 days where you'd get out. And actually, I brought my support team in, and I think we had 10 people on it, which was pretty big. But they split into two teams, came back, and within a few weeks had solved some big, hairy problems that had never been solved before, you know, because they were just either being worked on side of desk, or the teams that were involved, these steering committees, were just way too big.
It's counterintuitive to go after smaller teams. It feels like I'm part of a big organization. We've got all of these resources. We should be able to throw as much of that at it as needed. But that it's just incredible what you can accomplish on a small team. So then if I want my organization to survive in this new world of human experiences or customer experiences, however, whichever one of those you choose as the focus point, maybe you can give us some tangible examples of how to best get started in that case.
Yeah, I think it becomes sort of really having an honest look in the mirror at where you're at. And sometimes that's hard, especially if you've got a leadership team that's been in the business for very long, in the same industry maybe, and it's harder for them to see what's changing on the outside. So sometimes getting creative with how you make that known to them, especially if they're not necessarily knocking on your door saying, hey, we need to change. You know, it's not always happening that way. One of the maybe more analytical ways to do it, which works in some cultures, is an assessment, customer centricity assessment, if you will, which takes a look at those three areas of customer-centered design, customer-centered delivery, and customer-centered culture, asks some questions, ideally has somebody maybe from the outside that comes in and has some objective view into it and said, well, you guys all rated yourself 10 out of 10 on all three of these things, but we talked to frontline folks and they disagreed. Or, you know, you start to look at a 360 view of the organization. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's where you have the aha moments, right? And it's usually the one guy, I think it was at Motorola years ago when I was working for Citi, they were a customer of ours. It was an offsite with the execs, and one of the guys, and this is, you know, third-hand news, but I'm assuming it's right, stood up and said, our quality sucks. And that started the whole journey down towards Six Sigma, of a metric that Galvin could use across all his business units to measure quality. So you have to have those aha moments. The centricity assessment is one way to do that. Sometimes if the leaders already say, hey, we need to get better, and how do we do it? Then it becomes more maybe some of the examples I shared where you're architecting a workshop or some execution where they're getting out of the building and learning some new tools and techniques and starting to architect those three buckets of design, delivery, and culture.
Interesting. There's a couple of questions in the chat, one from Noel and one from Mariana that I think are fairly similar. So thinking about work in the context of a product company compared to a services company, specifically, you know, consultancy-based company services bucket, different in a services company than in a product company.
Yeah, I get that a lot. I think typically you come in with a discipline and somebody says, well, that works here, but it doesn't work here. At the heart of it all, you know, you have to identify who the customers are. Sometimes there's multiple customers. In the business I was in at Citigroup, we dealt with manufacturers of equipment, we dealt with dealers, and we dealt with end users. And all three of them had different needs, and we were delivering products that had different benefits for them. So getting a sense of, you know, what are the key benefits that your products or your services offer, and getting that really narrow. You know, sometimes it's time savings, or it may be confidence, or it may be, you know, helping me sell to my customers better, excuse me, but getting to a point of what are the benefits, who are the right customers, and then what is the journey they go on? I think whether it's a consultancy or it's a pure service business or it's a manufactured product, every customer of those services is going on some kind of journey with you. And it usually starts with searching to say, are you the right provider? I have an issue or problem. How do they find you? How do they talk to you? How do you sell to them ultimately? And how do you bring them on board? I've found no company that has told me we have a perfect onboarding experience with new customers. You know, that seems to be one of the toughest challenges. Net promoter scores are always lower. People jump ship really early in the first year or month or whatever it may be. And then what do we do during the life of that? How do we stay relevant? In banking, once we sold you a mortgage, are we going to ignore you for 30 years and just hope you buy another product from us? You know, there has to be a way to engage that customer during an engagement if it's a consultancy, or during a life of a loan if it's a service. And then what happens at the end? You know, do you come back? Do you recommend? So I think a lot of the tools make sense. It's certainly not off the shelf, because it's different for every company. But I don't think you would say, hey, design, delivery, and culture don't work in my industry. It's just how you do it and who the customers are that may differ.
Absolutely. Yeah, my co-founder, Brant, created a framework in his last book in The Lean Entrepreneur called the Value Stream Framework, that basically takes the lean manufacturing value stream and applies it to this context of innovating and try to create that experience that creates passionate customers. It basically describes the mental states that your customer go through from first becoming aware all the way through becoming passionate about that product or that service, or it could be applied to employees. What does it look like for them to first become aware of my company all the way through loving working for the organization, inviting their friends to come and work for the organization? So for those of you that are watching, that's available for download on our website. So you can go grab that for free. It's a really powerful tool for where those bottlenecks in the experience are for your customers, and, you know, targeting the empathy and the experiments to drive the biggest impact possible for whatever your organization is.
Yeah, and I think too, and we didn't get too deep into it, but in execution, there's a number of things you probably need to do in most businesses. Building some sort of customer listening system, once you've launched your product, how do I know that it's delivering the value that I actually desire it to deliver? And how do I listen to customers? And that may not just be surveys, but it might be things that give you specifics around, hey, that customer called me three times today and abandoned all three times. Should somebody call that customer back? Or how do you derive analytics from a lot of those transactions? And how are you listening, learning, and then iterating? Just like you would starting to design a new product, how do I continue to innovate and design and improve the existing products that I have and the existing services?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's, I've got a question along. So actually, wait. Transition. let's dive into Q&A. I have a question. One of the clients that I'm working with, has got, it's an insurance company. And I think, you know, they've got a handful of customer experience folks. but I think organizationally, there's still a bit of a question as to like, what really is our product? Like mm-hmm. and so I'm curious, like in that example, it sounds like with the XOs, is that right?
Yeah. Experience owners.
So in that case, if I've got an insurance offering, I'm going to have an experience owner that's maybe handling my, I don't know if I've got homeowners insurance policies as an example, like in that example, for that product and potentially that's, you know, targeted at a set of customer segments. And so I need to look at from end to end, from the customer first becoming aware of our company all the way through becoming a passionate customer, regardless of whose realm that falls in the business, I'm responsible for that from end to end. But if you think about like that, you've got the initial onboarding of customers, you've got support, you've got billing, you've got these other sort of functional things that are happening. So in your experience, you'd have an XO at the top of that looking at the entire experience, and then you'd have some other experience owners for sort of the sub experiences, or like how does that look like? Your experience, what has that looked like inside organizations where it's been successful?
Yeah, I mean, I think what you described is the ideal state, right? So you have somebody with a fair amount of knowledge and clout as that experience owner. It's a pretty high level position. They don't have a big team. They have a small team, but they have a lot of influence and a lot of authority. And then the experience champions may be function heads or department heads. But the trick for the XO then is to say, okay, well, I know this offering, let's say it's an insurance product, the key benefit is peace of mind or financial security or whatever it is the customer really bought you for. You know, what did they hire you to do? And then you work your way back and say, okay, well, at each of these touch points, then I need validated insights on what does awesome look like so that they get an awesome experience end to end. And so they use a lot of these techniques that you would in designing a new product to design that end to end experience, and then setting up some way of knowing that. So whether it's a metric dashboard or a service blueprint, some way that XO has visibility into performance, red, yellow, green across all of those touch points, and that there's a regular review process going on, or in ideal world, more of a push that is automated, especially in the software business where you start, or any kind of online experience, you can start to say, hey, if this goes below a certain tolerance or this many customers call about that or whatever it is, flags are going off and we have a recovery process. I love the visual. If you haven't toured a Toyota plant, find one near you and go do it. And then think about how do I put that in place in my service business or my consulting business? Because I was in Georgetown, Kentucky, touring the plant there. It was a startup I was with. They were a customer of ours. And the song starts playing on the line, and everybody's on our tours. What is the song? And these lights are flashing. And they said, oh, that means that there's a potential defect at this station in the assembly line. And if they don't fix it within 52 seconds, then they're going to have to pull that andon cord. And that means Camrys stopped coming off the line. Every 52 seconds, a Camry was coming off the line. And engineers came running. They fixed it. They never had to pull the cord. But they had designed a service recovery process to alert them when there was a problem and then solve common problems within the 52 seconds, which I just thought was insanely amazing. And in a service business, the only challenge is it's usually invisible. We don't watch it like they do. You can't see it. The songs aren't playing. But in the digital space, there's so much opportunity to instrument your offerings and your products to do it that way that the XO can always be getting a text alert, or one of the champions, the XCs, can be saying, hey, we had a problem, but we fixed it in whatever, 52 seconds. No worries. And then there's some retrospective that goes on and some strategic planning about where are we taking this in the future. But it's a little bit of a different way of working. But that is what you're seeing at these companies that are getting all three of those elements right, is it is a pretty much a fundamentally new way of thinking and working in the business.
Yeah, it's very, very different. I love it. Well, we don't have any other questions at this point. If you have a question, now's a good time to ask. If you're watching on the live show, now's a good time for that. Any other tips and tricks for getting started? Take us that direction.
Yeah, I think the one thing maybe I would want to have you think about in getting started is don't settle for being good, you know, settle for being awesome. That has to be the motivation. And you may look, and if you don't know that, that's even maybe something you've got to start with, is saying, where are we compared to our competitors? A number of folks I talked to at this conference this week in Atlanta didn't know that. You know, their companies knew what their own net promoter score or their own measure of customer delight was, but they didn't know what their competitors were. And they relied maybe on some third party data, but there wasn't an apples to apples. And it's harder to do that, but it's absolutely critical for your senior leaders to know how far off are you from the best. Because if you're not, if you look at the Bain research, if you're not 10 points higher than your nearest alternative in net promoter, you're probably shrinking and they're probably growing about twice as much as you are. And so just saying, hey, we're at parity with, or we're within the top quartile of our industry, is not going to be good enough as disruptors keep coming in. And we saw this in banking. We saw it in healthcare. I mean, the money in Silicon Valley that was going into tech is looking for new opportunities now. So a lot of these highly regulated companies that, and some quasi-monopolies, are getting disrupted by workarounds and different solutions because there's a lot of money flowing in there. So if you're one of those big companies, you've got to really kind of create that burning platform to say, how far off are we and how are we going to get there? What's the chart that we're, you know, the trajectory we're going to take to be best in our industry?
We do have a question. The question is, as you expand, how often should you revisit the culture and the values core?
Wow.
So if you're going from like, you know, maybe an original like 8 people that you interact with inside the organization, you want to move up to, you know, 30 or more.
Yeah.
How frequently should you look at that?
Yeah, I think it's kind of an ongoing journey, is at least my point of view on that. You know, companies that I've been with that did a good job of that, it was at least annually. You know, it was a part of the strategic planning that happened, the short and long term planning. They looked at all those elements. They looked at the culture. They looked at the talent. They looked at the processes. They looked at the product portfolio. And a lot of times it was an ongoing all year event, right? So you had small teams sort of always kind of working through that. And you maybe had a balanced scorecard or a dashboard, and culture was a metric there. You might have associate surveys. You might use your customer insights to see if the behaviors are where you want them. You know, there's some really forward-thinking companies thinking around how do we build talent capabilities and behaviors and measure those things within the company. So I don't think it's maybe just, you know, we pop up every so often and check where we're headed and then the, you know, submarine goes back down and flies blind. I think there's always got to be a periscope up to have a sense of how's the culture doing, because things change so much. Especially if you're in a tech business or tech related, which most of us are now, you're having to be really nimble and agile. And in this human experience era, I think the thing, if you think about my description earlier of the journey we've been on from product to market to UX to CX and now HX or human experience, it seems like those are coming faster and faster. And the culture you need to be a human experience company versus a CX or UX are all different. And so I don't know what's after HX, but I suspect that's coming pretty quickly. My niece is a senior in high school right now, and she's very different than the millennial generation. And I suspect she's going to be driving a lot of the purchase power, and we're going to have to adapt our cultures to her generation pretty quickly.
Absolutely. Yeah, and in many of the organizations we work with, I'm going to get a little bit meta for a second, but the value stream framework that I was talking about before, we actually apply that with the employees. So if we have these, is whatever the number is, we have these values as an organization. If you look underneath that It's a set of behaviors that you want your employees exhibiting, your employees and leaders exhibiting consistently. And you should be able to put the right instrument things in the right way to be able to measure those and see that you know, it's not perfect, but you can get a really good sense of where the organization is at any point in time. I mean, the just through natural attrition and the new employees coming in these organizations, like you could, you know, with a whatever that is, with a 20% attrition rate, the entire company turns over within 10 years. And so the entire culture of the company could shift just by doing nothing. So
well, that idea of voice of
measuring is really important.
Yeah, I was going to say that idea of voice of the customer versus voice of the boss applies here as well, because what is the market? What does the customer need around our culture, and how does our culture adapt to that? There may be some things that never change because that's just the founder's preference for the company. But to be competitive, you may have to constantly be reassessing the market and saying, hey, our culture is too slow, or, you know, we're not innovative enough. I know, you know, some companies have to kind of reinvent themselves, but you'd rather be ahead of that than wait till it's too late and go out and have to buy your innovation.
I know you did a lot of work with accountants at Intuit. I'm curious, in that context, you think about like a smaller firm, you know, 10, 20 employees, something like that, is great for them?
Sorry, you cut out. Like? What was the question?
Uh-oh.
I got the first part.
I know you have a lot of experience with like accountants and accounting firms, and we did a lot of small business work at Intuit. Is it appropriate for a small accounting firm to have an XO? How does that look for a small organization?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you start, typically small companies start with one product and, you know, a handful of folks. In that case, you know, it may be the CEO or the COO that's the XO. And as you grow and have multiple products, then you might have, say you got 10 people and two products. Do I want an XO, you know, for both products, separate XOs? The beauty of a small team like that, it is a two pizza team, is everybody's doing everything. So you don't have the complexity of, you know, did marketing let the call center know before they sent out the big blast of emails, and then we got all these calls and the reps didn't know what they were talking about. That doesn't probably happen, hopefully, in a company of eight people. But I think as you start to see your scaling, that's when really that XO role comes into place. And it doesn't have to be a product manager per se. It could be a COO or CTO or whatever the design of the company is. It just needs to be somebody that has that responsibility. But even in a small company, somebody has to be the CEO at Intuit used to always say that you can have more than one approver on a decision, but one of them always gets 51% if you have two. So you've got to have somebody that essentially the buck stops there on a decision of what you're going to do strategically with those products.
I think if you're empowering your employees to be out with your customers and those kinds of things, even as a small organization, that takes a quick reminder of what's most important for our customer in this decision. Did you keep that in mind when you made that decision? And a little bit of coaching and mentoring with your employees can often drive really significant impact. And the XO in that context is just sort of the guardian of making sure that the customer is front of mind.
Yeah, and really in a small company like that, the mechanisms are almost more important than the roles. So if you have no way of getting all the key players together who deliver your product on a regular basis to say, how's it performing and where do we need to improve? And then quickly, the Toyota example, when the alarms go off, how do you fix it? Those mechanisms have to be well understood. And then the XO's role may be less important if those things are working really well.
Yeah, great example. Awesome. Well, we are at the top of the hour, so we should probably wrap up here. For folks that are watching, if they want some help or they have some additional questions, things like that, please don't hesitate to reach out to either Mike or myself. Mike, how can people get a hold of you?
Yeah, my email is mike@thecustomerlab.com or Delight Apostle on Twitter. And on LinkedIn, I've got an article that kind of goes into more detail about some of this, and glad to email that to you as well. Certainly enjoy partnering with News and Needle as well. So I'm sure if you contact them, they can wrangle me up as well.
Yeah, pretty easy to find. Awesome. All right, cool. Well, thank you for watching. And Mike, thank you so much for your time today. This has been really wonderful.
Yeah, thanks everybody.
I talked over you. You say that again, please.
Oh, I'm just thanking everybody for joining us. Appreciate you spending the time with us.
Hey, this is Aaron again. Just a couple quick questions before we wrap up. What is your organization doing to ensure that you're staying relevant in this new world of human experience? In what ways might you personally lead by example and use that to create a movement inside your own organization to create more value for your customers? See, if you're listening to this podcast and not taking these things and applying them in your work, then you're wasting your own time as well as mine. And that's why I do this work, is because I love seeing the impact that others have. So please drop me a quick line or a tweet, whatever your preferred method is. Share what insights you acquired through this episode, how you've applied them in your own organization. And of course, if you've still got questions, hit me with any questions you might have, and I will be answering them in future episodes. Until then, see you next week.